This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Over the weekend, on Sunday, I was up in Seattle. Saturday, actually, both days. We came back Sunday. We pulled in, the train pulled in right across from the stadium where the Dalai Lama was filling the thing up with over 50,000 people. And then I went down to the Green Festival, which was also packed. It was incredible. 1,000, 1,500, I don't know how many people showed up to hear my talk, but every seat was taken, and a lot more. And it was a wild time. I mean, what a great and activist city. And I want to tip my hat to all the great folks in Seattle. His Holiness talking about the importance of compassion in action, which is one of the themes that he came back to over and over and over again during the week that a small group of us spent with him in Dharamsala at his home, and McLeod Ganj, his actual home, in India back in 1999. That trip, by the way, has been made into a movie that is narrated by Harrison Ford called Dalai Lama Renaissance, which is playing in theaters around the country right now. But nonetheless, it was a great weekend, and the issues of the day, I think, are so, there's such a vital issue here. We have on this planet, if you can just consider this for a moment, and by the way, where I'm going to take all this is this faith thing, the faith forum that was held last night, where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both spoke, and this whole controversy about whether Barack Obama is an elitist who is out of touch with Americans or whether he's a truth teller. And I'm going to try and play this down the middle without taking sides on pro or con candidate, but I have a very strong position on pro or con this issue, and I'm just lay it out. But here we have 6 billion people on planet Earth. Major front page story, not front page, but a major full page story in today's Financial Times about how many nations, identifying all the nations around the world now, that are starting to implement political, that are passing laws to make it a crime for a company that processes or grows food or processes food or wholesales food to ship food out of that country, to export food. All around the world, there are countries that are saying, that's it, no more exports of food. And as a consequence of this, the food importing nations are experiencing 100%, 200%, 300%, 500% increases in the cost of food. The United Nations World Food Program, which when we were in Darfur four weeks ago, they are the major supplier of food to the refugees, that, at least that we were seeing. And in fact, just 15, 20 miles away from where we were, 3 days after we left, 3 UN workers driving a truck full of food were murdered for that food and for that truck. It's the biggest problem that the UN World Food Program is having right now is that they can't afford the cost of food, because the cost of food is going up, in part because of this food inflation, in part because of the worldwide economic uncertainty. But I would say, and there are some partisans out there who are saying, in part because of biofuels. And you know, in the United States, using corn to produce ethanol, yeah, there's some real legitimate issues there, but there are a lot of non-edible crops that can be used to make biofuels. And ethanol, frankly, I don't think is necessarily the best one, biodiesel, but we really need to be moving toward electrolysis and hydrogen. There's a mind-boggling amount of electricity that can be generated with solar panels in our deserts, and that electricity can then be used to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. That hydrogen then can be transported all over the planet, just like we transport oil right now, and can be used as a fuel in fuel cell cars. And that's one of the reasons I'm so pleased to see GM has got this new fuel cell car coming out, and there's others talking about this. You can have in your garage. You could have a little unit that generates hydrogen out of water and electricity. And you know, let's decentralize all this stuff. But in any case, here we have almost 7 billion people on the planet. All of human population, from the founding of humanity up until 1800, we had fewer than 1 billion people. In the year 1800, we hit our first billion people. So the year Thomas Jefferson was inaugurated as president, we hit our first 1 billion people. Our second billion didn't happen until Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated as president. In the 1930s, we hit our second billion. That's how long it, you know, I mean, this is how slow it was growing. Actually, it was growing fairly quickly at that point. 165,000 years, the first billion, the second billion only 130 years. The next billion, though, only took 30 years, 1960. The year John Kennedy became president, there were 3 billion. Fewer than half the number of people on the planet today. The fourth billion, 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion, 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion, only 11 years, 1999. And now we're well into our seventh billion. We have a crisis going on all over the world. And it looks like a crisis of population. I would submit to you it is a crisis of culture. And there are two dimensions to this. One is the rise of corporate power and the rise of basically the ancient kingdoms. The rise of aggregated wealth. The corporation, prior to the 1880s, corporations had to be dissolved every 20, 30, or 40 years, depending on which state they were created in the United States. Corporation could not live more than 40 years because nobody wanted there to be a tool that could be used by wealthy families to create basically the landed gentry that we fought a revolutionary war against in the United Kingdom. And the corporation is, as you can see with the Walton family, for example, is a great tool, or the Marriott family or the Hilton family, you know, on and on it goes, is a great tool to have intergenerational wealth protected from, for example, laws that have to do with inheritance. So it used to be you had to dissolve corporations. All that went away in the 1880s and 1890s as corporations were given more and more rights. So there's that problem. And that problem is leading directly, and then also there's the other dimension of this, and this is a very important dimension, and that is that the other part of the population explosion has to do in part with the greater availability of food. I mean, there's a simple equation. The more food there is with any species, the more that species will grow. But in addition, we find that there are large parts of the world where population is not growing. And those parts of the world are those cultural subsets of the world where population is not growing tend to be the ones where women have relatively equal power with men. And so, and in those countries and in those places and in those cultures within countries where women are treated as the property of men, population tends to be exploding right now. And whether it's polygamous Mormons or whether it's fundamentalist Muslims or fill in the blank, I think you can make a very strong case that the most powerful human rights movement in the world is the women's rights movement. Having said that those two issues, in my opinion, are the things that are driving the explosion of population in the world and the crushing of people, particularly that first one, that corporations have acquired now First Amendment rights of free speech, Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, Fifth Amendment rights not to incriminate themselves, 14th Amendment rights against discrimination, none of which were conceived of by the founders and framers of our Constitution for corporations. In fact, if anything, the opposite. They have acquired all this power. One of their major cheerleaders was the guy who made over a million dollars a year as a corporate lawyer advocating for this personhood of corporations, a guy by the name of John Roberts, who went down to Florida during the 2000 recount, and because he had been the intern, there's an actual title for it that's escaping me, for the Chief Justice Rehnquist, he went down to Florida and coached the lawyers in the George Bush versus Al Gore lawsuit and how to argue before Rehnquist. And John Roberts is now the head of our Supreme Court. So here we have the ongoing destruction of the American middle class at the hands of a corporate elite and an elite of aggregated multi-generational wealth in the United States. Ever since Reaganomics, and this is the point that Barack Obama made last week, 2 weeks ago now, that for the last 25 years, he said, I'd say for the last 28 or 29 years, ever since Reagan came into office, well, arguably, you know, it was 2-3 years into Reagan's term when he really, really, Reaganomics really went on steroids. So for the last 25 years, to use Obama's phrase, we have seen real incomes of working people in this country stagnate at the same time that the cost of everything has been going up. And people are slammed. People are pinched. I mean, this is the essence. This is the core of Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Shouldn't every Democrat be out there talking about this? Shouldn't every Democrat be out there defending the statements that Barack Obama made, that people who are economically insecure have historically looked to government, but for the last 25 years, government hasn't helped, so they're looking elsewhere? 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We wake up each morning and start every day with coffee, espresso, and grande lattes. Racing the traffic and bitch while we wait. Pissed at the world for making us late. We punch and then lunch it, then punch out again. Rush home to clean up the messes we left. Microwave dinner, then put it to bed. Tomorrow we'll do it all over again. That's just a day.
America working itself to death these days. What 30 years ago you could do with one single income in a family now takes two or three or four jobs. You got people working, you know, half a dozen different people, or excuse me, half a dozen different jobs sometimes in a single family that are being worked by multiple people just to bring home the food. And people are looking at their pensions have gone, their union is gone, the corporation, the company that used to run the steel mill or the textile mill or whatever, the manufacturing jobs are gone, and people are upset. They are angry. They are bitter. And when you, well, rather than my doing the rant. First of all, here's Hillary going after Barack Obama for his comments.
Senator Obama is a good man. And he is a very talented and gifted man. But I think his comments were elitist and divisive. And the Democratic Party has been, unfortunately, viewed by many people over the last decades as being elitist and out of touch.
And you know, respectfully, and you know, again, I say this as somebody who will vote for Hillary Clinton in a heartbeat if she's the nominee of this party. Respectfully, I would say that the extent to which the Democratic Party has been portrayed by Republicans as elitist, here you had George W. Bush, who was born with a multimillion-dollar trust fund, running ads that showed John Kerry windsurfing. John Kerry, not born with a multimillion-dollar trust fund, although he has recently married a woman who's worth a lot of money, but nonetheless, portraying him as some kind of an elitist. You know, John Kerry was the guy who went to Vietnam and got shot at. George Bush was the guy who spent a year AWOL in Alabama getting drunk and trash in a house. And so, anyhow, that. Barack Obama, talking about this issue, not directly responding to Hillary Clinton, but actually responding to John McCain. I mean, it was the Republicans in the media that really, really ran with this thing. And here he is.
When I go around and I talk to people, there is frustration, and there is anger, and there is bitterness. And what's worse is when people are expressing their anger, then politicians try to say, what are you angry about?
Yeah, see, this is that whole thing. Hey, wait a minute. You know, it's not our job.
This just happened. I want to make a point here today. I was in San Francisco talking to a group at a fundraiser. And somebody asked me, well, you know, how are you going to get votes in Pennsylvania? What's going on there? We hear that it's hard for some working class people to get behind your campaign. Why is that? I said, well, look, they're frustrated. And for good reason, because for the last 25 years, they've seen jobs shipped overseas. They've seen their economies collapse. They have lost their jobs. They've lost their pensions. They've lost their health care. And for 25, 30 years, Democrats and Republicans have come before them and said, we're going to make your community better. We're going to make it right. And nothing ever happens. And of course they're bitter. Of course they're frustrated. You would be too. In fact, many of you are. Because the same thing has happened here in Indiana. The same thing happened across the border in Decatur. The same thing has happened all across the country. Nobody's looking out for you. Nobody is thinking about you.
And that question, you know, who's looking out for you, is Bill Riley. Bill Riley's favorite question, who's looking out for you? Well, it should be we. It should be we collectively. But as Thomas Frank points out in his book, What's the Matter of Kansas, with Kansas, people, when they can't rely on government to deal with the economic issues, and they have, and they're powerless themselves because corporations have been given all the power, and now we're seeing that the corporations are not even having their tax returns audited compared to the average guy, then they turn to other things.
And so people end up, they don't vote on economic issues because they don't expect anybody's going to help them. And so people end up, you know, voting on issues like guns and, you know, are they going to have the right to bear arms? They vote on issues like gay marriage and, you know, they take refuge in their faith and their community and their families and the things they can count on. But they don't believe they can count on Washington. So I made this statement. So here's what's rich. Senator Clinton says, well, I don't think people are bitter in Pennsylvania. You know, I think Barack's being condescending. John McCain says, oh, how could he say that? How could he say that people are bitter? You know, he obviously is out of touch with people. Out of touch. Out of touch. I mean, John McCain, it took him three tries to finally figure out that the home foreclosure crisis was a problem and to come up with a plan for it, and he's saying, I'm out of touch?
See, I think this is an issue. Frankly, I think Hillary Clinton has played this just the wrong way. She should have jumped on it with Obama and said, yes, the Republicans, 25 years, 30 years of Reaganomics has destroyed this country economically. She should have criticized Obama for being inarticulate, but not for his message. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So who's got the attitude? And what attitude is it? 31 minutes past the hour. Excuse me. 34 minutes past the hour. Boy, I need to get stronger glasses here. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, with you. See, this is such a core issue. This is such an important issue. Our number 866-303-2270, by the way, we'll be picking up your calls in just a second. And if you want to drop into our live chat room and participate in a lively conversation on this and other topics, go to TomHartman.com and just click live chat. It'll get you over there. David Brooks was talking to Chris Matthews about John McCain and kind of bumped up against this stuff sideways. But basically, it's about how perception trumps reality. Here's Chris Matthews asking the question of David Brooks, you know, how can McCain deal with this whole issue of, for example, abortion? You know, how's he going to, you know, you've got working class white folks who by and large are in favor of a woman having the right to choose. And I mean, I don't think anybody's pro-abortion, but, you know, they're in favor of at least that decision being between a woman and her physician and her priest and pastor or rabbi or whatever. And Brooks takes it off in a different direction.
David, the question that a lot of women especially care about is choice, abortion rights. And although they may like the cut of his jib because he seems like a maverick, a sort of a suburban independent type, not part of some machine, he does relentlessly say he's for strict constructionists. He likes Scalia. He likes Roberts. He likes Alito. How does he break out of that?
Now, we're talking about McCain here, and he's talking with David Brooks, the conservative op-ed writer for The New York Times.
He doesn't. That's what he believes. He's believed that for 30 years. The guy is pro-life. He's a conservative. The way he breaks out of it, though, electorally, is to beat Teddy Roosevelt. And this is going to be the toughest thing for his campaign.
Now, wait a second. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican, or Franklin Roosevelt, the Democrat, who brought us the New Deal and brought us the Social Security and brought us unemployment insurance?
He's got a group of people around him and, frankly, a group of party that doesn't want the government to do anything to help poor people.
Right. But Franklin Roosevelt did, but not Teddy Roosevelt.
And he has to break out of that. He's begun to do that on housing.
Especially when there are more poor people now.
Right, but he's got to say, hey, Teddy Roosevelt took on corporations. He took on the health insurance. He took on the trust of his day.
Well, he didn't take on health insurance. He did take on the trust in the corporation, sure.
And it's going to be up to, and this is going to be the toughest part of his campaign, is breaking out of the restrictions on the role of government to be aggressive.
In other words, to become a Democrat. Say what? I don't think it's going to happen. Or become a progressive, let's say. Because Teddy Roosevelt, even though he's a Republican, was a progressive by and large. In fact, he left the party and formed the Bull Moose Party. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Mike in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Oh, there's a lot on my mind, but I'm going to keep it down because I know you don't have a whole lot of time.
And we've got a lot of calls.
Listen, I really appreciate the fact that you came on Wisconsin Public Radio. It was a great, great show. I think you're so much better there, too.
Thank you.
And I just want to say that although I agree with Obama, and I definitely agree with his pastor, too much of a deal was made of that. But I just think you're talking about what the right says about the left and what Obama says about Clinton. It's blah, 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 blah. That's all I've been hearing. I noticed that you haven't used the F word. And the one guy that came out and used the F word this season was Ron Paul. And
You're saying fascism.
Fascism,
right.
Thank you.
No.
It's a word that the moment you start using it, I think, Tom, you're guilty. You're afraid of being called a conspiracy.
Mike, I use the word fascism on this show probably at least once a week.
Well,
and I've written two books that have entire chapters on how America is becoming fascist and the history of fascism. I'm sorry, I just, you know, I reject your assertion that I'm afraid of that word. And I would agree with your position, assuming that that's your position, that America is moving in the direction of fascism, both in the loss of civil liberties and rights in the Bush administration, but perhaps more importantly in the merger of corporate and state interests, which was that, you know, original comment. Anyhow, Glenn in Forest Grove, Oregon. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Hey, you know, I'm this Obama thing with the vocabulary or the... Actually, I don't think he was inarticulate at all. I think he was right on what he said. And, you know, you could always say it takes one to know one for Hillary Clinton to call him an elitist, but her husband's continuation of the Reagan policy during his presidency has put this country in a state where it's okay to be socialist when the big corporations have financial problems, because God knows in the big picture, if they didn't bail them out, it'd be a lot worse. But the government's what put us there by their lack of regulation and oversight of the private sector. And then when they can't even come in and help out the little people, I guess, or the non-elite.
Yeah, the average person. And spot on, Glenn. And this is where I, frankly, my call on this is for Hillary Clinton to elevate the discussion, to stop using Republican talking points, at least in this case, and not try to trivialize this very real issue that for 25 years, ever since Reaganomics took hold in this country, we have seen the destruction of the American middle class. Here's a quote for you. The reason Bush's tactic worked so well, this is the tactic of dividing people along lines of race and gender and sexual preference. The reason Bush's tactic worked so well is that you have all these economic insecure white people who are scared to death. That's a quote from Bill Clinton in 1991. He went on to say, this was in 1991, you know, Bush wants to divide us over race. I'm from the South. I understand this. This quota deal they're going to pull in the next election is the same old scam they've been pulling on us decade after decade after decade. When the economic policies fail, when the country's coming apart rather than coming together, what do? They find the most economically insecure white men and scare the living daylights out of them. They know if they can keep us looking at each other across the racial divide, if I can look at Bobby Rush and think, Bobby wants my job, my promotion, then neither of us can look at George Bush and say, what happened to everybody's job? What happened to everybody's income? What have you done to our country? End of quote from Bill Clinton in 1991. Paul in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Paul.
Hey, I love your show. I wish it was on longer on Sirius. I just wanted to make that point, too. I heard Saturday morning, I heard on a news station Hillary making the comment about the comments being elite and out of touch. I'm like, was she getting talking points from Fox? I mean, that sounds like something you would hear on Fox. And then I hear that this Governor Ed Rendell or whatever goes on Fox and says that they're the most fair coverage of this primary process. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. It concerns me a lot. And let's civilize this discourse. Let's actually talk about the real issues rather than calling people names. Elitist is calling somebody a name. Kim in San Francisco, you want to take the other side of this?
I actually do. And you know, one thing I've got to say, out of this whole debacle, and believe me, what Obama said is a blunder, and it's a huge blunder, and I'm going to tell you why. We in the Democratic Party far too often make fun of these people ourselves. Why? Because, hey, they're mostly white like us, the beer-drinking, gun-toting, religious redneck. I'm telling you right now, we make fun of these people at our party's own peril. They are the people that didn't ask for that much out of life. They simply play by the rules. They did everything that they were taught they should do, and they've been screwed. And if they feel bitter, they have a right to feel bitter. And yes.
That was Barack Obama's point. I mean, this is the world
that I grew up in, Tom.
You know?
I understand what Barack's point was, but he was condescending. And how they can take this whole thing that happened with Barack and turn it into a negative against Hillary.
That's why I'm saying she should have criticized him for being inarticulate. She should have criticized him for saying it poorly, because he did say it poorly. I agree with you.
He
did say it poorly. She should have criticized him for saying it poorly, and then she should have said, but the real issue is that the Republicans have been destroying the American worker for 25 years. And here was a great opening for her to become, you know, the progressive candidate, to champion the progressive cause. And instead, she's simply saying something that is going to end up in a John McCain commercial.
Okay, but I still can't believe that we are taking our focus away from how Barack said it and what he said. You guys, we don't have
I don't think that's the important point. The important point is we need to put our focus, and we need to put the nation's focus on the fact that for 30 years, the American middle class has gotten screwed by Republican policies.
Okay, but I still
Isn't that the real issue?
Pardon?
Isn't that the real issue? Not whether or not Barack Obama has acknowledged and apologized for being inarticulate, for saying it poorly, for saying it badly. And he did say it badly. But the point remains that it's real. It's true.
It is true. But okay. The other point is that, yes, we can have an impact on trade and things like that, because there are more of us that feel the way that we do, that it needs to be fair trade, not free trade. He made it sound like it's all inevitable.
No, I agree, and I wish he hadn't brought trade into it. As I said, I agree with you. He was inarticulate. He said it very poorly. Yet there was a truth behind all that I think Hillary Clinton, had she embraced, could have used much more powerfully than just beating up on Barack Obama. Thank you for the call. Jerome in Detroit. Hey, Jerome, just a half a minute here before we got to take a break. What's up?
Okay, Tom, how are you doing today?
Good.
All right.
But
what I'm calling about is that I really don't understand why is there so many Americans so afraid of the truth when they hear it. When they hear it, it's like they deny it. They constantly deny it. And what he had to say and what many other officials say, you know, that when they do speak the truth, we turn our back on it. Because it's like we don't want to hear it.
Well, it's this soundbite culture, Jerome, and let's try to pander to the lowest common denominator. And I think it's tragic. I think it's important that America, just like with race, and I know that Hillary Clinton has the ability to rise above this kind of rhetoric and take on these serious issues. I know she has that ability, and certainly her husband did in 1991. I wish that she would come to that now. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The True People's Radio. Tom Hartman.
You see everything. You see every part. You see all my light. And you love my dark. You dig it.
9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Program. Powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for workers' safety. You can find out more about it over at teamsters.org. Our program also powered in part by you, our listeners, letting our local affiliates know that you're listening, letting our local radio stations know what you think, letting our advertisers know that you're listening. getting their bumper stickers. I was at Talk 1090, our Seattle station's booth yesterday, day before yesterday at the Green Fest. Sat in the booth for, I don't know, a couple different times for about a half hour to whack, and met a lot of listeners. It was great fun, and we passed out a lot of bumper stickers. Put bumper stickers on your cars. You know, go to your local station, ask them for a bumper sticker, stick it on your car. Pass the word. Strange things happening out there, as we say from the wire service here. One day after Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton professed an abiding affection for guns and hunting, her love of firearms came under attack from another sometime hunter in Washington. Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, Vice President Dick Cheney said that a hunting contest between him and the New York senator was the only way to determine whether Senator Clinton's tales of her gun prowess were for real. To be frank, the vice president told Tim Russert, Hillary Clinton's stories about her adventures with guns don't exactly pass the spell test. If she really wants to show that she knows how to handle a rifle, there's an easy way to do that. Meet me in the woods. While some in the Clinton campaign expressed concern about their candidate accepting Mr. Cheney's challenge, the idea of a hunting contest got the ringing endorsement of one member of her inner circle, former President Bill Clinton. Dick Cheney and Hillary in the woods with guns, President Clinton said at a campaign stop in Pittsburgh. Boy, I like the sound of that. But shortly after the vice president issued his challenge, Senator Clinton seemed to back off from her earlier claims of hunting experience, saying that she had misspoke about her hunting exploits as a child. I fired a gun once, she said, but I didn't like it, and I didn't recoil. No, obviously, it's Andy Borowitz, and BorowitzReport.com. It ain't real. Thank you. Thank you, Andy. 866-303-2270. Melinda in Pensauken, New Jersey. Am I saying that right, Melinda?
Pensauken. Thank you. I just wanted to real quickly say I agree with you totally, and I'm really disappointed in Hillary. I'm not a Barack fan or a Hillary fan, but I think I'm a Barack fan now, and I agreed with what he said totally.
Yeah. Well, this isn't enough to cause me to say, you know, I'm going to move in or out of either camp. I'm still agnostic on this. I still think that it's important that as long as this process is viable and as long as both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton agree that the process should continue, that it should continue. And I think either, as I've said many times, I think either one of them would make a great president. I think Hillary Clinton has the potential to be the next Franklin Roosevelt. She's a real policy wonk. She knows this stuff inside out. I think that Barack Obama has the potential to be the next John Kennedy, a charismatic leader that can bring the country and the world together. I think that Hillary Clinton could reinvent America in a very positive. Either one of them actually has the potential to be, you know, all of the above. But I wish that the Clinton camp would instead of going with the Republican talking point,
right,
that it's elitist to talk about the middle class, people like, you know, my family, my brothers who are union workers, the kids that I grew up with in the south side of Lansing, Michigan, you know, everybody working at Oldsmobile or their fathers working at Oldsmobile, that instead of, you know, saying that if somebody's talking about people like that getting whacked, and I can tell you, I go back to Lansing, Michigan, and as I do several times a year, where all my family's from, where I grew up, and there are, you know, what were vibrant middle class neighborhoods when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s and 70s that are now just, you know, falling apart. I mean, housing values are in the tank. And to say that to discuss the very real economic pain these people are experiencing, and that because they've given up on government, because, you know, both Democratic and Republican politicians and administrations have given them promises and haven't given them answers. And therefore, you know, it's an elitist comment to say, I'm sorry, it's not. It's telling the truth. Thank you, Melinda, for your comment. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max.
Real quick, I had forgotten. I remember that quote of Bill Clinton's way back then, and that's why I still like Bill Clinton. I know there's a lot of humbug there, and I mean, as far as his millions, well, I guess revenge, living well is the best revenge. Yeah. But I'm from Missouri, and I don't want this to sound cornball, but Harry Truman, who was not cornball, once said that the American voter, something to this effect, I don't know if I have this exact quote down, but effect, as the Democrats acting like Republicans will never succeed because the American voter knows the real thing. Hillary Clinton cannot out Republican John McCain on this kind of crap.
And in fact, the second half of that quote from Harry Truman was, he said, and given the choice, mm-hmm, between a Republican or a Democrat who sounds like a Republican, and keep in mind Harry Truman was a Democrat, the American voters will elect the Republican every time.
In other words,
you know, people will always go for somebody who is consistent and true, and they'll also vote for the Democrat every time who sounds like a Democrat. And crossing over like this, I think is frankly, I think the Clinton campaign is shooting themselves in the foot, and I think it's a tragedy.
Regardless of what the negatives are about Senator Clinton, it's kind of, there's no way I agree with you, she should have been on the attack with this stuff. Criticize Obama for maybe being inarticulate or not watching what he said. But there's just, I think Senator Obama should start using the Bill Clinton quote from 91.
Yeah.
Because this is the fact.
Now, real quick, Tom. Sure.
Okay. They don't want, now we all, and like that lady was talking about, you know, we were talking in our little group, she was saying how Democrats, she thought Democrats do make fun of people. Well, I don't want to get into that whole thing, but there is a fear of being too critical where it comes in about the great Gipper, Ronald Reagan. But they're going to have to start to, the Democrats, Obama or Senator Clinton is going to have to communicate with our people about what has happened in the last 30 years. And also, they've got to start pointing out that under Democrats, business does very well. You've talked about this.
You can go back 100 years. Every time there's a Democratic presidency, the stock market goes up. When the Republicans come in, it tanks.
Talk that stuff.
I know. I got it. Max, we're out of time here. We've got to wrap up this hour. In our next hour, we're going to be talking with Deal Hudson, Dr. Deal Hudson, a McCain surrogate and Catholic activist who's going to talk about Reverend John Hagee. This should be an interesting conversation. We'll continue this discussion of the political status of this country.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Dr. Deal Hudson is with us. He is a Catholic activist and the author of Onward Christian Soldiers, The Growing Political Power of Catholics and Evangelicals in the United States, director of InsideCatholic.com. Of course, that would be the website. And Dr. Hudson, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Very glad to have you with us.
Thank you. You
wrote in your website, InsideCatholic.com, recently about your meeting with the Reverend John Hagee, who John McCain solicited the endorsement of, and then along with that endorsement came a subsequent firestorm of protest, largely from Catholics, about Hagee's comments about Catholicism, calling it a godless theology, blaming the Holocaust on Jewish disobedience and rebellion, saying that Katrina was the judgment of God against New Orleans. I get that, that's not anti-Catholic, but... It's
anti-hurricane.
I guess. You know, it's... I don't get it. I mean, it's... First of all, tell us about your meeting with John.
Well, first of all, Tom, you may not know, I'm an old Texas Baptist before I became Catholic. I actually was a Southern Baptist minister many, many years ago, coming out of Texas. So when the meltdown occurred with the John Hagee endorsement, and Bill Donahue, who's a real good friend of mine, as you might expect... I got a call from a mutual friend of Hagee and mine suggesting that I meet with him and just try to explain to him what all the problem was. And I met with him. He was a very, very gracious and open man. And he admitted that some of the things he said were one-sided, especially about Catholic violence against the Jews, in the sense that all of his examples were usually taken from the history of the Catholic Church and from nowhere else. But he also explained that the furor over the great whore symbol in the Book of Revelation really was a misunderstanding. Now, you don't want me to go into Christian eschatology here on this show, but in fact, I think he's right. I think he's off the hook on that. I think it's the Catholic Church and the Jews that he has some study to do, and he's willing to do it.
Well, that's reassuring. On the other hand, you have folks like Falwell, for example, the late Reverend Falwell, who would take a position and just that's it forever, world without end, amen. I'm curious how, as a Catholic and as a Catholic activist and publisher of InsideCatholic.com, you can be a surrogate for John McCain when he is so enthusiastic about the war in Iraq. And when Pope John Paul II, and I believe Pope Benedict since, I know Pope John Paul II spoke out strongly and forcibly against the United States invading Iraq, and after the invasion, against our maintaining an occupation there.
Okay, well, I'm not an official surrogate, but I have, I have signed a list.
You're on his
support.
Catholic steering committee, are
yeah.
you not?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Surrogate, I was a surrogate for the Bush White House. That's what I think of as surrogate. Well, that's a good question. It's a fair question. And I think that I've said, you may have seen that I think the Iraq War is the biggest problem McCain's going to have with Catholics. I mean, otherwise, it's pretty much a repeat of 2000 and 2004. But I think the Iraq War creates a certain opening for whoever the Democratic candidate's going to be, and just for the reasons that you say, there has been serious criticism of the war going all the way back to the beginning from the Vatican. If you'll remember, John Paul II sent a special emissary to the president.
This was in 2002.
Yeah, way back. This was when I was advising the White House on Catholic affairs. So, yes, it's fair to say that the Vatican has opposed the war, raised questions about the war, and Catholics around the country understand that. I mean, they also understand that there's no official Catholic position on the war.
But Pope John Paul II, I spent an hour with him, with a small group of people in Castle Gandolfo in 1998 at his invitation. I did not solicit this, and then had a private audience with him afterwards. And in the larger meeting where he talked for about 15 minutes, I mean, it was prepared notes, but he talked about the importance of ending wars around the world, that war was a legalized form of mass murder and that it was fundamentally immoral. And I mean, this was in 98, and this has long been, or at least recently, long been in within our certainly lifetimes, the position of the Catholic Church. It's been a very pro-life position. The Catholic Church has also been a leader in being opponent for the death penalty, which John McCain also supports. It seems to me that these issues, these fundamental issues of life and death, and certainly, war is PM. Is one of the largest. I know that you may argue that abortion is the other. But it seems that that would be a real stumbling block for Catholics in their support of John McCain, if they really understood how outspoken Pope John Paul had been. And you can tell me right now, I haven't been following Pope Benedict's proclamation.
This message will be saved in saved message folder. Recorded April 2nd.
But just let me go back to something you said. I mean, the Catholic Church is not officially pacifist. The Catholic Church teaches that there can be just war. Now, let's just pass that one by, and let's pick up on the issue of the fact that many Vatican leaders, including the popes, have expressed serious reservations about this war. Catholics understand that regardless of that, it's not up to popes to make decisions about whether wars are just or not. It's up to the head of any country. Now, absolutely, wars are bad. Absolutely, war should be brought to an end. But again, the pacifist position is not one that the Catholic Church has taken, and not one that John Paul II took.
I understand that, and I wasn't trying to represent it as such. But if then you're taking the position that the Pope, whether speaking, what's the phrase?
Well, he's not speaking infallibly.
Yeah, from the chair on behalf of God. Mm-hmm. Whether or not he's speaking that way, that the popes are should not be determining the political leanings of Catholics in America, then what about the letter that the current Pope Benedict sent to American Catholics back just before the 2004 election, or at least to Catholic leaders in the United States, to I believe it went out to
the
a number of bishops,
yeah,
suggesting that and it was obviously aimed at John Kerry, although it didn't name him specifically, that politicians who advocate politically that women should have the right to choose an abortion should not be allowed to take communion. And this, you know, turned into a huge deal.
This is
the insertion directly into American politics.
I mean, this is very important that you bring this up, because a lot of people don't recall that this Pope who's arriving here tomorrow is the man who was heading the office of Doctrine of the Faith.
Yeah, the office of the Inquisition.
And this document, which was sent to all the bishops of the United States, but was very quickly sent out, you know, along the internet, you know, was to reaffirm the fact that certain issues, life issues, are non-negotiable, not compromisable politically, and that Catholics should not support politicians who support abortion or euthanasia.
But shouldn't it also have said Catholics, for the exact same reasons, will not support politicians who support this war in Iraq?
No.
Why not?
For a simple, very
isn't
simple,
death death?
You know, very simple distinction, because one is a prudential matter and the other is not. In other words, there is such a thing as a just war, but there's not such a thing as a just abortion.
But the Catholic Church, but the position of the popes has been that this war is not a just war.
Yeah, but that position is not something that is obligatory for Catholics to agree with. The way the Church's position on abortion and euthanasia does oblige Catholics.
That's interesting. It's a distinction. I understand what you're saying. And
I know you do. It's a matter of what is a prudential matter to be decided.
So then, in that context, do you think it's appropriate for the Vatican hierarchy to insert itself into the American political discourse?
Well, let's put it this way. In general, no. I mean, I agree with you there. I don't think that the hierarchy should try to insert itself. The hierarchy should do its job, and that is to teach and then let Catholics decide for themselves what they're going to do with that.
Yeah, I would think so. And
I wrote a column a month or so ago saying we've had entirely too much religion in this campaign already.
Yeah.
For me.
Agreed. We're talking with Dr. Thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Deal Hudson, he's a publisher of InsideCatholic.com. And recently met with John Hagee, the pastor who's been so controversial in the campaign of John McCain. Dr. Hudson, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Interesting conversation, thought-provoking conversation. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Now, Larry Craig scares me, the senator from Idaho. All his Republican buddies are telling him he's gotta go. You see, they think that being gay is some kind of disgrace. All around the Senate and the House, they make that case. The fact is, they've got enormous closet space, and that scares me. Dick Cheney scares me with those beady eyes. They get intense and glary every time he lies, which is like every day now. He's got a machine where his heart should be, just pumping out an evil philosophy. He shoots people in the face and gets away scot-free, and he scares me.
Yeah, he scares a lot of us.
Coulter scares me.
Welcome back.
Now I got
Housing Urban Development Secretary Alfonso Jackson is leaving office this week. Good riddance. But this is the guy who was supposed to be responsible for making sure that people have housing in the United States. You recall during the Reagan administration, Reagan cut HUD's budget from $65 or $68 billion down to in the teens. As I recall, it was either $13 or $15 billion. Just radically cut the budget of housing and urban development. And all of a sudden, within a year, what did we see? As low-income housing vanished, we saw homelessness. And since then, those of you old enough to remember before Reagan, you'll remember we did not have homeless people in the United States after World War II. Until after Reagan. Well, Alfonso Jackson not only, you know, continuing the fine tradition of Reagan of offering money to shelters but not to actual housing, but even went beyond that. As the Washington Post said in late 2006, as economists warned of an imminent housing market collapse, Housing Secretary Alphonso Jackson repeatedly insisted that the mounting wave of mortgage failures was a short-term correction. He also, by the way, this guy who's leaving, see, this is the Brownie of housing. And this story is not getting covered by the corporate media because he's reciting the same mantra all these other corporations want, and the very large, monopolistic, unregulated, in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act corporation want, which is, don't regulate us. Don't make rules. Don't break us up. In fact, Alphonso Jackson, as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, as Secretary of HUD, was pushing for legislation. Well, here, to quote the Washington Post, he pushed for legislation that would make it easier for federally backed lenders to make mortgage loans to risky borrowers who put less money down. He issued a rule that was criticized by law enforcement authorities because it could increase the difficulty of detecting and proving mortgage fraud. Fraud! Fraud! We ain't got no stinking fraud. This is just a correction. You just turn everything over to the big corporations and the big, they'll do everything. The banks, they know what they're doing. Don't worry about it. What, you think they're dumb? No, they're greedy. And then on top of that, he goes out and using taxpayer money. At the same time, he launched a new $7 million auditorium and cafeteria at HUD's headquarters and used taxpayer money to solicit an emergency bid to obtain an oil painting of himself. So the guy can spend a couple $100,000 on an oil painting of himself, but he doesn't want regulators to look into what's going on in housing. Now, at the same time, in today's Financial Times, this is the other side. This is like, you know, talking about FEMA and then talking about Katrina. So the analog of FEMA, another insanely incompetently run federal agency because it is being run by ideologues, Republican ideologues, in this case, Jackson, Alphonso Jackson. The same thing, you know, just like with Brownie and his superiors over at FEMA. So now in the Financial Times today, the headline, G7 concern over disorderly slide of main currencies. Now, guess what's one of the main currencies in the world? You got it, the dollar. And the G7 is worried about what they refer to as a disorderly slide. In a headline, disorderly slide. You know what that means? That means disaster. This is not the alarmist Ravi Batra. This is the Financial Times. This is the G7, the Group of Seven Industrialized Nations. In fact, here's the first sentence. The Group of Seven Industrialized Nations has signaled shared concern over the danger of a disorderly slide in the dollar and sterling, the British currency. It signals the emergence of a new consensus on the risks posed by extreme currency weakness. But Hank Paulson, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, another one of these right-wing ideologues and multimillionaire, remains skeptical of the view that policymakers should try to second-guess market-determined exchange rates. Right. So Hank Paulson, just like Alphonso Jackson over at HUD saying, hey, we don't need no stinking regulations. We don't need to pay attention to the market. Don't worry. Housing going down in the tubes. It's only going to hit the middle class. Come on. What are you talking about? It's just a correction. Hank Paulson, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, same thing. Oh, the dollar's sliding. Well, you know, dollars slide. Sometimes stuff like this happens. The market will sort it all out. Mr. Paulson, there is no market. Markets are created by laws and rules and treaties. Markets are based on stable currencies and appropriate and legal behavior by the participants in those currencies. And we have none of the above right now. Oh, man. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I fell into a burning real fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher, and it burned.
34 minutes past the hour. So, a lot on the table. By the way, let me just add to this whole thing about the administration. They don't want to regulate currencies. They don't want to keep they don't want to control, you know, make sure that we have a strong dollar. They're not really worried about the insanity of the fiscal policies that they've been pursuing. And another article from today's Financial Times, the headline, focus of tax audit shifts to smaller U.S. companies. Large U.S. companies were audited less frequently by the IRS last year, and examinations were less thorough. It's the lowest level in two decades. Well, if they're not auditing big companies, who are they auditing? Well, the IRS ramped up its examination of small and medium-sized companies. Why? Well, IRS examiners coming in as replacements need to be trained on smaller companies before they can tackle larger audits. And Senator Chuck Grassley, the Republican, who's on the Senate Finance Committee, says, quote, these corporations are struggling in this tough economy. He's talking about small and mid-sized companies. These corporations are struggling in this tough economy and trying to keep jobs in this country. The last thing they need is the IRS showing up on their doorstep just to make their numbers look good. Yeah. I never thought I'd agree with a Republican, but apparently I am. But I don't agree with Silvio Berlusconi. Our Berlusconi alert. A small-time crook and independent businessman who bought a newspaper, then he bought a radio station, then he bought a TV station, then he bought another radio station, then another TV station, then another newspaper, then two more radio stations, then he bought a radio network, and then a TV network, and then another radio network, and then another TV network, and pretty soon he owned all the radio networks and all the TV networks, and all but one of the newspapers, major newspapers in the country, and then he ran for office! And guess what? Twice! What a surprise. He was elected prime minister. Well, he's running again in today's elections. And Mr. Berlusconi's latest remark, Silvio Berlusconi, this is from Reuters, who has been biting his tongue for most of the April 13-14 election campaign, said last week his opponents on the left have no taste in women. The left has no taste even when it comes to women, he said. As for our, these the right-wing women candidates being more beautiful, I say that in Parliament, because in Parliament they have no competition. Yes. Mr. Berlusconi. As crazy as they get. But when you own every radio station, every television station, and most of the newspapers, I guess you can be prime minister with that kind of language. Eh? There should be a lesson in there for the rest of us. And let us not forget, it was Italy where the idea was first developed, of merging corporations and states. In fact, back during the Roman Empire. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Alan in Gulfport, Mississippi. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I want to make a prediction, not what I want, but what I fear will happen in Pennsylvania. The Republicans are going to get involved, sir. And I want to alert the people, Obama and Clinton going into the election will be very close within the margin of error. And Clinton will win big by 12 points or more. As a result of the Diebold machines, the Republican Party will have three main objectives in pulling this off. Number one, plausible deniability. In the general election, they can do it statewide in many states and turn back and say, no, you can't believe the polls. You can't believe the polls. Look what happened in Pennsylvania. Look what happened in New Hampshire. Obama was ahead in New Hampshire, and Clinton won big. Can't trust the polls, because, Tom, there's only one thing left that can stop these Republicans from total voter fraud, and that is the if they can get people to understand that the polls can't be trusted, there's nothing left, because we cannot confirm what's in those machines.
Yeah, no, Alan, I hope you're wrong about Pennsylvania. I agree with you, though. Broadly speaking, that we don't know what's going on inside those machines, and it's a crime. If you're going to privatize the concession stands at Yellowstone, okay, I think it's wrong, but I'm not going to fight you on it. If you're going to privatize the local public school's cafeteria, you know, I think it's wrong, but I'm not on the school board. But when you privatize my vote, The beating heart of democracy? And interesting story up at the top of Drudge Report. McCain, Hillary can still pull it off. Senator prefers Clinton contest. John McCain certainly would rather run against Hillary Clinton. And I don't, you know, this is just reporting the thing straight up. But I, you know, whether the Republicans are going to hack the machines or not, I don't know. It's Marilyn in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Boy, it's hard to be optimistic these days, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, the good news is that a lot of people are waking up and a lot of people are becoming activists. I mean, I was amazed at the Green Festival in Seattle day before yesterday. There was thousands and thousands of people there. 50,000 people at the exact same time. Over 50,000 people showed up to hear the Dalai Lama. People are waking up in America in numbers that I haven't seen since the 60s, and I think it's a good thing.
Okay, I have another wake-up call then. Okay. You know, we're not very good at framing things on our side, and the right seems to do it so well. So I have a suggestion. Why don't we start talking about the right wing and McCain as regressives as opposed to progressives and start framing things in those terms? You can take any topic, and you can pretty much apply it, I think. So if you talked about the environment and or fueling automobiles, if you talk about renewable energy as a source, you know, at various levels, including cars, as opposed to fossil fuels, which are killing us, killing our environment, ruining the economy and everything else, and, you know, giving us wars to fight. And I just thought if we could start calling them regressives, they might sound like the scum that they are.
Well, it's an interesting one, and thank you for that, Marilyn. I think that elite is the word that I would like to... elite is a powerful word in our culture, a powerful negative word. We have, since the Revolutionary War, we have had a revulsion to elites, and the Republican Party is in bed with inherited wealth and major corporate power. Make no mistake about it. And it's the one charge that they cannot deal with. They don't have a response to. And McCain is trying to run his campaign. He's trying to run like a populist, and we need to call him out on it. Brenda in Montclair, New Jersey. Hey, Brenda, what's up?
I was just calling because I remember in 2000 when I was so excited about the Gore-Lieberman ticket, and I voted for Mr. Lieberman in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm looking at Hillary Clinton, and I am honestly seeing her as another Joe Lieberman.
I don't think you can say that. I'm sorry.
Well, I feel that there's something here that she is not doing something positive for the Democratic Party, that she is using her run for the presidency to bash Obama,
but see, that's,
rather
that's,
than to fight against McCain.
No, I understand, Brenda, and I have all along said that I think that the winning strategy for Hillary Clinton, if she really wants to win this thing, is to take on McCain rather than Obama and prove to us that she can do a better job of beating him than Obama. That said, she's, you know, fighting against Barack Obama for the nomination. On the other hand, Joe Lieberman is an ideologue. I mean, he's a right-wing ideologue. I don't think that she is. I really think that she's a traditional Democratic ideologue, and I just disagree with her tactics in this campaign, or some of them.
Then I see Joe Lieberman out for Joe Lieberman, and really not out for America. And unfortunately, in this last 6 months, I've seen that turn in Hillary, that Hillary is out for Hillary and not out for America.
Well, that's what you do during a campaign, you know, respectfully. But you know, I think that, you know, she served New York well as a senator. I don't know. I'm not ready to call Hillary Clinton a Joe Lieberman. I'll leave it at that. John and Scott,
yeah,
thank
great,
you, though, for the
great
call.
Great program, great comments, especially on Financial Times. I wanted to take issue, a very strong issue with you on this Hillary Obama issue. And I want to remind you of Pelosi when she took charge of the recent Congress. She made a wide-open declaration claiming that impeachment is off the table. I'm sure you remember that.
I do.
But in effect, you know, was that a political thing to do? Why not just keep that quiet and let the Congress deliberate and you'd have a...
She actually said that before the elections. I think before the elections it was not inappropriate for her to say, because she would have been the beneficiary of an impeachment.
Before the Congress actually began its proceedings. Mm-hmm. And I want to go to this Hillary thing. What I see her doing, and this is why I take issue, is she's taking the class issue off of the table, and she's signaling to the elitist club that you were just beautifully described that, oh, no, we're not going to mention the class versus the ordinary citizen in terms of the Iraq war or subprime mortgages or layoffs. I mean, she's sending a clear signal, and she and John McCain are whistling exactly the same tune.
Right, and I don't, and here's the thing. I don't think that that's consistent with her worldview or her politics. I think that she got really bad advice on this. I think that Mark Penn or whoever said, "Oh, here's something we can go after him on," and she's
No, she's saying it, Tom. It's coming out of her mouth. Her mouth, yeah. And you can't get around that. She is declaring allegiance, in effect, with the Republican. Look at Ferraro. She's appearing on right-wing talk shows, guys.
No, I know, and you could argue that, you know, she feels like she's been pushed into that corner. But, John, your point is well taken. Let's just hope that she can come back from this, that she can recover her poise as a Democrat. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. You can find out more at teamster.org. With our daily update on the news of the world, Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And Ellen, our accredited White House reporter, accredited congressional reporter, accredited UN reporter. In fact, I'm going to be broadcasting from the United Nations sometime this summer with you, aren't I?
You are, and it's pretty exciting. Now, we're going to try and have some really good guests there. We're actually putting in our wish list right now.
That'll be in June, as I recall.
June 5th.
June 5th. Great. I'm looking forward to it. So what's happening in the world, Ellen?
Okay, well, first of all, let's start out with Iraq. Not great news out of Iraq today. There have been quite a few deaths inside our city. U.S. forces are fighting the Shiite militias there, and not great news on that. And also, al-Sadr wants to reinstate the people that the government fired for not participating in the Basra event. As you know, a lot of guys in the military and police just sort of exited out, and they were fired from their jobs, and now al-Sadr says he wants them all reinstated.
So you don't mean al-Maliki, you mean Sadr, the cleric, wants the people who refuse to fight against his militia, or were they fighting against, are these guys fighting against the Badr Brigades, the old Shia militia, or are they fighting against
Well, it was a little unclear, but remember al-Sadr declared a truce, and then everybody stopped fighting. So whether they were his people or under his influence or not, but I guess he's running the country if he wants them reinstated.
Wow. Amazing.
Those purple fingers for voting somehow, I guess, didn't.
Well, he did win. Sadr did win a third of the seats in Parliament. I mean, although he's in Iran right now studying to be a mullah. So I think it's a little odd that he's calling the shots in Iraq and we're, man, it just gets messier and messier and messier the longer we stay in there.
It certainly does. The president today had a cabinet meeting. He said that by the second week in May, people should be getting their rebate checks. He also talked about his Hope Now initiative and the FHA Secure initiative, and said that 1 million people have been helped to not have to declare the end of their mortgages and to have their home.
Do you think that that's true?
I have no idea, because the papers have been saying that the Hope Now thing has not been very successful.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any kind of numbers that would back that up. But in fact, in today's Financial Times, there's a whole piece about how the subprime crisis continues.
A million seems awfully high to me, unless these were people who were kind of teetering but not there. I mean, I just don't know where he got those numbers, and it may be worthwhile us asking at the White House where those numbers are coming from.
Yeah, that would be an excellent question. I agree.
He also said that he doesn't believe in helping out lenders or speculators, The Columbia Free Trade Agreement also came up, and he talked about how important that was and not playing politics with that. On the Supreme Court today, there's a man who served 24 years. His name was Thomas Goldstein. He was convicted in 1979. His murder conviction was overturned, and he is now suing the LA County or the LA prosecutors in a civil rights suit, and the Supreme Court agreed to take it.
This is one of those cases where the guy, where there was clear evidence of prosecutorial misconduct.
Absolutely. There was a guy who said under oath that he was not, given anything, essentially, not given a plea or whatever, to talk about what he heard in his jailhouse hearing. But in fact, he was given time off his sentence, and he helped, quote unquote, convict 10 other people, apparently.
Right. So this is prosecutors basically buying perjured testimony of convicted criminals in exchange for less jail time in order to convict people to drive up their numbers, to make themselves look good.
Exactly.
And
that's
why
I would never be a prosecutor.
Yeah. Are you an attorney?
Am I what?
Are you an attorney?
No, I'm outside here. Outside of the UN, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay.
Also today on defense issues, that looks like that will be coming up for a markup. That is the House Appropriations Committee. And the president says he doesn't want this a Christmas tree. He wants his $108 billion for defense, but that is it.
Yeah. So he wants his money for defense, and he wants his money for the oil companies, and he wants continuing protection for the nuclear industry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One other really interesting thing. The House Education and Labor Committee, they're going to have a markup of a bill today. It's the same day the Pope is there. And they want the chairman of the House committee wants to make it so that all these little charges that are on your 401k account gets accounted to the consumer. Well, the 401k companies are saying, no, 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 no. We'll give people a broad view of the charges, but we're not going to tell them what each and every charge is for.
Oh, that's interesting. And this is sort of like the same thing with mutual funds. I mean, there's all these buried fees and charges in there and ways that they basically screw people. I mean, so the industry is pushing back and saying we don't want transparency. And who is pushing for the transparency?
Well, George Miller and the Education and Labor Committee, the Democrats on the committee, Republicans are not very excited about it.
Yeah, well, of course, they're getting a lot of money from financial services industries. And besides that, the Republican philosophy is corporations can do no wrong. And so, we should keep our hands off them. Incredible. And the Pope is coming to town, you said.
Pope will be here on Wednesday at the United Nations on Friday. I mean, here being Washington, D.C., even though I'm not there at this point, I will be there tomorrow. And on Friday at the United Nations, doing two masses in New York, one at the, I believe, Shea Stadium and one at Ground Zero.
Wow. Fascinating. Thank you very much. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for the update, the news update for the day. Thank you, Ellen. 57 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman program. Coming up next, Corey Powell from Discover Magazine, the Better Planet issue.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, John McCain taking a bold stand on torture, making it clear, very, very clear, that we cannot torture any Americans.
Americans. Clear. In my support of the Detainee Treatment Act, the Geneva Conventions, etc., that there may be some additional techniques to be used, but none of those would violate the Geneva Conventions, the Detainee Treatment Act, which I was the author of, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment, and we cannot ever in my view, torture any American. That includes waterboarding. And if I could just tell you, and nothing that would violate the Geneva Conventions of which we are signatories to.
Right. So we're never going to torture any Americans. Well, Mr. McCain, I am reassured, although I would recommend that you visit our prisons. Because I would submit to you that in a number of prisons, we are torturing Americans right now. We are in violation of international treaties and laws. Speaking of, you know, what's going on in America and what's so and what's real, you've many times on this program, you've heard me talk about how we stopped teaching civics in the United States in the 1980s for all practical purposes. And the point that I make, and you know, those who lived through that era or who had kids in school during that era, we had our children were in school in the 1980s. You know, we saw it happening, and in fact, it was in the media. I mean, it wasn't like some kind of secret. The pogrom, the purge that is going on right now against liberals on college campuses, where you've got right-wing talk show hosts saying, you know, hey, record these guys and send us the audio and we'll play it on the air. And you've got, you know, just this absolute campaign. And who's David Horowitz, for example, he's out there, you know, oh, we're going to get these commie professors, you know, forget about tenure, all these other things. That campaign that's going on right now on our college campuses is the tail end of a process that began during the Reagan administration against high schools, against those unionized teachers and those liberal textbooks that talk about things like the history of the union movement. You know, how dare we be teaching our kids that? And so I've pointed out many times in this program that the teaching of civics in many cases faded out entirely and in other cases changed to the point where it was simply memorizing dates. You know, what year did Columbus, you know, 14, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Okay, you're great. Okay, you pass. Good. Did Columbus have anything to do with the slave trade? Did he take the Tejano Indians there as slaves back to... Well, I don't know. Good. If you don't know, that's fine. Then we have a good civics class. Because, in fact, he did. In fact, he was involved in the child sex trade and wrote about it. But nonetheless, you won't find that in our textbooks. I don't think you ever probably would have found that in our school textbooks. But nonetheless... The simple facts of the history of America, the progressive history of America, the labor union movement, the history of the Republican Great Depression, none of this stuff is in our textbooks anymore. But it's worse than I thought. It's worse than I thought. There is a new textbook. Actually, it's not new. It's the textbook that has been in use for years. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's called American Government. And Andy Revkin on his .earth blog, Andy Revkin's .earth blog, attacked this textbook saying, you know, it's got all these climate deniers in it, and it's got all this nonsense, and it's not telling the truth, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And Houghton Mifflin responded. They replied to him. They said, the authors do not provide a history of global warming. Rather, they use the issue to illustrate entrepreneurial politics. As part of this illustration, the book cites a wide range of sources from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at the IPCC to Nobel Prize winner Al Gore. Last year, we revised the 11th edition of American Government, which included some revisions of the entrepreneurial politics section. These revisions reflect current developments in environmental policy research. Okay. So let's see what the book actually has to say. First of all, Houghton Mifflin says, the authors do not provide a history of global warming. Okay. Here's from American Government, 11th edition, page 556. Quote, second, many environmental issues are enmeshed in scientific uncertainty. The experts either do not know or they disagree about what is happening and how to change it. For example, some people worry the society is burning so much fuel, thus producing a lot of carbon dioxide, and cutting down so many trees, thus reducing the plants available to convert carbon dioxide back into oxygen. Boy, that's not even accurate science. Anyhow, that the Earth will soon become a greenhouse. The excess carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere will prevent heat from escaping, and so the Earth will get warmer with disastrous effects for humanity. But there are some signs. I'm still quoting from the American government textbook that your kids are using in school. But there are some scientists who say that human activity is not a major result of global warming. Instead, they argue it is the result of natural changes in the Earth's temperature. The book continues. According to James Q. Wilson, entrepreneurial politics is a situation where the costs are heavily concentrated on some industry, profession, or locality, but the benefits are spread over many, if not all, people. In Wilson's mind, it is the government that burdens industry with regulations rather than industry burdening the people with pollution. Is this getting strange? The book cites twice a paper by Sally Balunas, an astrophysicist, who claimed that the ozone hole didn't exist and works for right-wing, industry-funded think tanks like the Marshall Institute. This textbook that our children are using to study American government quotes Bjorn Lomborg's book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, a book that has been found guilty of scientific dishonesty. The National Academy of Sciences Climate Change Science and Analysis of Some Key Questions is mistitled as Climate Change and Analysis of Some Key Questions. It includes articles by the Brookings Review about state-level policies. None of the references are from an IPCC publication. The reference including, they talk about activists, Al Gore, and contrast them with skeptics, like Seitz, Easterbrook, and Michaels. And then it goes on, but our natural concern for global warming must address three difficult questions. First, we do not yet have an accurate measure of how much human activity has contributed to the warming of the Earth. The Earth has become warmer, but is this mostly the result of natural climate changes? Or is it heavily influenced by humans putting greenhouse gases into the air? Second, if human activity is a main contributor, what would it cost in lost productivity and income to reduce greenhouse gases? Third, since America acting alone cannot eliminate greenhouse gases, we have to figure out how to get other countries, especially rapid-growing ones such as China and India, to absorb their share of the cost. Third, how large would be the gains to humankind, and when would they occur? And it goes on. In fact, the there's a growing movement to suggest to the publishers of some of these textbooks, you know, that the right has been lobbying these guys forever to say, enough already, let's bring back the real history of American government. Let's bring back some of the true principles on which this country was founded. Let's talk about some of the real issues. Let's deal honestly with this stuff. You know, but it ain't happening. At least so far, because so far all the pressure has been coming from the right. And now we have, you know, the textbook publishing has been concentrated in a very, very small number of very corporate hands, well, publishing in general. And some of these companies are not even American-owned any longer. So it's like, you know, how can we expect our kids to get a decent, well-rounded education when education itself has become so political? And I realize, okay, here I am on the other side politically saying, wait a minute. I would be real happy with just a discussion of these issues going down the middle. But to say when the vast majority of the world scientists say, hey, this is a fact, this is a given, here's a million pieces of science to back it up. And then you got a few crackpots who are funded by, in large part, large industries, the carbon industries, saying, no. To say as if it's like, oh, yeah, it's a balanced debate. You know, Sweden imposed a carbon tax. I believe it's $140 per ton of carbon. And what happened when they imposed the carbon tax? Their economic activity almost tripled in those areas, in new technologies.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Man.
21 minutes past the hour. What's going on with the Real ID Act here? Idaho is the latest state to reject this thing. Hannah Saona. Saona? Hannah Sauna, right?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry. The Legislative Council for the ACLU of Idaho, the website acluidaho.org, is on the line with us. And what's happening in Idaho with the Real ID Act here, Hannah?
Well, we had a great victory this session. We passed House Bill 606, which is binding legislation that opts Idaho out of Real ID completely. So that means it joins seven other states that did so last year, and Idaho will not be implementing the Real ID program.
Now, this I find absolutely fascinating. A while back, if I was a guest on a very, very right-wing show. I was on, you know, there's a couple of these right-wing shows that are on shortwave stations.
Uh-huh.
They're literally like they're broadcasting to people in cabins out in the woods with
right.
you know, a year's worth of food and 35 machine guns, and
uh-huh.
and they go beyond right wing. I don't know how to be and you know occasionally they'll invite me on and we'll discuss you know stuff, and the real hardcore you know keep my guns you know guys. People are just as upset about the Real ID Act as are the progressive movement. I mean, it's not very often that something comes along. Actually, the loss of habeas corpus is another one that's got everybody horrified.
Right.
That, you know, there's a number of things that have come down from this administration that I think because they are uniting the right and the left and the middle by and large is going, yeah, it doesn't sound right to me either, but they're not, you know, so politically active that they're out there really churning the waters, that I think we can only describe them as anti-American. This kind of legislation.
Right. I mean, it's amazing the group of people that you work with on fighting legislation like the Real ID Act of 2005. I mean, we did a memorial last year in the Idaho legislature that just sent a message to Congress saying that we rejected Real ID, and this year we passed the binding legislation opting out. And really both times, especially this year, we passed it through the House and the Senate unanimously. There was never a vote against our bill. And we really had a lot of help from all over the political spectrum. We worked with other organizations, but especially the legislators. I mean, we had very far-right legislators as co-sponsors, as well as very progressive far-left legislators. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. It's a really great opportunity to bring these people together, like you said, and fight against these anti-American things that come out of Congress at times.
We're talking with Hannah Sauna, the Legislative Counsel for the ACLU of Idaho. ACLUIdaho.org is the website. Idaho is the latest state to reject the Real ID Act. Hannah, give us we just have 2 minutes here. Just give us a thumbnail sketch of the Real ID Act and what's so objectionable about it.
So the Real ID Act was passed in 2005, and the first objectionable piece of it was passed without hearings in the Senate. So it was kind of tacked onto a bill after the fact. And, there's a lot of concerns. The two main concerns that have states and organizations like the ACLU really worried, number one is the privacy concerns. I mean, Real ID envisions all state licensing department databases connected and accessible by all other states and the federal government. So you've got, you know, where now you have in Idaho, you've got the Idaho State Transportation Department. They have access to all of our records. But with Real ID, everybody across the country working in licensing departments would have access, as well as the federal government. So not only should we worry about government having too much access, but then you've got, you know, you have identity theft that's happening right now at levels, you know, when we just have states. Databases and now right. this is
and some states are actually subcontracting some of this stuff out to private corporations.
Right, which is obviously even scarier when you don't have kind of a government hold on this.
Well, I mean, the federal government right now has taken their terrorist watch list and they're making it available
right.
to large corporations. It's like, wait
right.
a minute, guys.
Right. It's pretty unnerving. And the other part that's more that the states have really reacted to is the cost. The Real ID Act carries a huge price tag, and the federal government has done very little to offer states money to implement it. So states, even in some states where privacy isn't their number one concern, they know that in the economy, with the economy the way it is, they do not have the money to implement a program like this. When we know it's going to cost us in privacy in the long run.
We now have in our passports, if your passport was issued after March of last year, it has a chip in it that will respond to interrogation by a remote device, that, and it will, because it can be scanned. So if a bunch of people were standing around with passports in their pockets, you could drive by, a police car could drive by, scan it, and instantly know the name and address and all the information of each one of these people. Doesn't the Real ID Act call for something very similar to that for driver's licenses?
Right. It's a little unclear. I mean, even with the final regulations that Homeland Security sent out, it's unclear what type of technology they're talking about in with all aspects. But it is a threat that you've got this chip in there that could be readable, like you say, a police car, you know, driving by, or even going into a store, like you said, private companies may have access.
Right. So the store knows who you are and where you come from and what your address is. And now we're in that Tom Cruise movie where it says, "Hello, Mr. Smith. You know, you want to buy another pair of Nikes?" Amazing.
Right.
Hannah, thanks so much for being with us. Hannah Sona, she's with the ACLU Idaho, ACLUIdaho.org. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. 803-2270, our number. Your call's up next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Love it. The Associated Press writing an article, McCain more conservative than his image, as the headline reads over at HuffingtonPost.com. Wake up, America! McCain is a right-winger! It's true. It's true. And let's see. In the last hour, we had a Berlusconi alert where we talked about how Silvio Berlusconi said that none of the attractive... Let's see. What did he say? He said the left has no attractive women. Only the right has attractive women. Well, and that was Italian politics.
Take off your coat.
So our full body alert?
Real slow.
Yeah. She had no desire to be just another smiling face in Italian politics, writes Phil Stewart for Reuters. So when Italian porn star Milly D'Abrasio designed her campaign posters, it was obvious she was going to show off her bottom. Her films that include The Kiss of the Cobra and Imperial Nymphomaniac. She hopes to capitalize on increasing disenchantment with Italian politics. She says, people don't want to see these politicians' faces anymore. Tapping into her popularity among pornography fans as an act of generosity. Those are her words to help Italy's socialists who will have put her up as their candidate in a municipal race. She said, I am the derriere of the Socialist Party. She also says about Berlusconi, who drew scorn recently for saying his party boasted the prettiest women in politics. She said, I think he's wrong because he lost the prettiest one, me. Okay, so much for that kind of stuff. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Marty in Delray Beach, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Nothing much, but to tell you the truth, I forget the name of the guy that had the wide stance in the bathroom. But his
yeah, Larry Craig.
No prize. Woof, his wife was no prize. But just to get on with McCain, it's a great intro to me. As far as I was just in an argument with a Republican talking about the price of the war has been grossly inflated, so I said a Hartman fact. I said $5,000 a second. Am I right or am I wrong?
You know, I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look.
Okay, because I really don't like to, you know, like I said, take them on. But I said $5,000 a second. You know, I mean, you hit them where the pocketbook is, where it's like, are you kidding me? I'm like, yeah. It might be close. But also, too, on McCain, you think we could swift vote him? Do you think we have really the guts to swift vote him and go back and find people that he yelled at?
You know, there's a bunch of right-wingers who are already doing that. There's a right-wing hit piece on John McCain suggesting that the only reason that he stayed in the Hanoi prison of war camp was because he knew that it would help him politically later on. And they interviewed a couple of guys who were in the prisoner of war camp with him, saying he didn't comport himself all that well. And it's, you know, it's clearly a hit piece. It's probably a smear. It's probably not even factually accurate. I have no idea, no way to know how to measure it. I specified, I put it on our website. oh, back about a month ago, and I said, you know, here's a right-wing hick piece against McCain. It's over on YouTube. You can probably track it down, or, you know, maybe we can find it on our website and move it up a little bit. But there is an attempt going on right now to go after John McCain by the real hardcore right-wingers. And, you know, but, you know, will the Democrats swift boat him? No.
You think that the Republicans will eat their own then?
Sure. Well, it goes beyond the Republicans. What's happening is the conservatives, the hardcore, you know, neocons, the hardcore Reich, rose up in the 60s after the defeat of Goldwater, rose up and took over the Republican Party solidly, bringing Reagan into power in 1980, and then started a purge of the party, which has been largely successful. I mean, they've got Olympia Stone, George Voinovich, and that's about it, Susan Collins. And they've pretty much gotten rid of everybody else. It's all, you know, really serious, what would have been described through most of the history of this country as right-wing crazies in political office. And it's kind of a mixed bag, because on the one hand, John McCain is a right-wing crazy. On the other hand, there's a couple of issues, like public financing of campaigns and immigration, where he didn't behave like a right-wing crazy when they wanted him to. And he's moving back in that direction now and saying, oh, yeah, I am a right-wing crazy after all. But he's got the hardcore right-wing crazies out to get him. And so I'm not sure it's Republicans eating their own, as it is the right-wing crazies trying to purge the party again. Marty, thanks for the call and raising the topic. It's interesting one. Al in Winchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Al, what's up?
All right. I'm calling about that real ID you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Yes, in New Hampshire there, the House and the Senate voted to reject it.
Yep, and New Hampshire is I lived there for 4 years, 5 years. New Hampshire is a very conservative state. On the license plates, which are, by the way, made by prisoners in jail, it says live free or die.
Yep.
So,
all right, one sad thing about it was Chertoff wrote like a nasty letter in all the editorials saying that New Hampshire residents wouldn't be able to get on planes or leave the country without it.
Right, and he had to back down from that, too.
Well, all right, it wasn't made all right clear in that. All right, up here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, it's Chertoff made those threats. And Al, thanks for listening to WHMP there, by the way. But I think that he's had to back off of that. Kathy in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk to you about textbooks and how we use them, or really how we don't use them.
Yeah, the topic I kind of kicked this hour off with, the freak show that has become our textbooks.
Exactly, and I'll go so far as to say good teachers don't use them. I mean, gone are the days where you have kids reading out of their book and answering the questions in the back for a number of reasons. And talking to a rather progressive principal in a conservative school who is in the position where he has to look for new textbooks, and he's even saying, you know, we don't use textbooks. Maybe as a guide to sort of, you know, give you the order of how to play stuff, but
right.
Never substance.
Yeah, and with No Child Left Behind, there is a certain amount of teaching to the test that has to be done if you want to stay in this education business.
Well, and even I think teachers, like if you look at health, social studies, and science, I mean, they're pretty much out of date as soon as they come off the printing press. You know, you need to be a teacher who's good at your craft, and you can be up there keeping on top of things and presenting things to kids, and we're just not using textbooks. They just sit on the shelf.
Right. Another reason why we need strong teachers' unions to insulate teachers from the winds of you know, the political fad du jour. Kathy, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening on AM 620 KPOJ. John in Buffalo, New York. Hey, John, what's up?
How are you doing today?
Great.
You mentioned that textbook. And there was a story on our local news here, school system near here, the parents were complaining about it. And the news story kind of made light of it, but I decided to dig into it a little bit and found out it was co-authored by a professor at Penn State and by a James Q. Wilson. And the more I got into it, the more amazing it got. You have to either be laughing hysterically or weeping openly by the end of this. He's the chairman of the Council of Academic Advisors of the American Enterprise Institute.
Yeah, is this the American government book you're talking about?
The government book, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, this is the exact same book.
Among his colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute, and incidentally, their motto is competition of ideas is fundamental to a free society. Among the people that are involved in this are, let's see, Paul Wolfowitz, Lynn Cheney,
And see, we go down. Some of the fellows who are involved are John R. Bolton, Newt Gingrich, Alan Keyes, and it goes on and on. It's like it's coming right from the mother load of the right wing Gary.
Yeah, no, I'm telling you, this is absolutely. Thank you, John. This is a campaign that started in the 70s, that was planned and organized in the 70s, that was funded initially by Richard Mellon Skaife and by Joseph Coors and a small group of very, very wealthy right wing donors, the Amason family out of Nebraska, I believe, and on it went. I mean, you know, I mean, there are some of them actually are believe that the United States Constitution should be amended so that we operate under the Bible instead of the Constitution. I mean, it is absolutely scary where some of this stuff is coming from. Anyhow, Gary in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hi. You talked earlier with Dr. Hudson, and he was saying abortion and euthanasia were pretty much sacrosanct and separated them out from war, which I think he used the word prudent for.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you were going to ask him about death penalty. Where does that fall in his listing?
Yeah, I raised the topic a couple of times. It would have been a good question. You're right.
I mean, it isn't prudent. As I think he would say. So,
see, this is where it just baffles me how selective, how the media and the right wing have been so selective in taking positions. I mean, I don't think most American Catholics know how outspoken John Paul was, Pope John Paul II was, about our invasion of Iraq. He was flipped out. That man was going on and on about it, and it was widely covered by the European press. By and large, it was not covered by the American press. I don't think most American Catholics realize how outspoken Pope John Paul was about
this. The death penalty was okay.
Well, no, he was very outspokenly against the death penalty also.
Yeah.
And but, you know, again, you don't hear that. And the Catholic Church has all across the world for centuries, but particularly for the last half of the last century or so, been, you know, major leading advocates for the poor and for progressive movements and frankly, even in favor of union movements in many places and against genocide by governments. And we've supported right wing dictators in the face of who have murdered in many cases Catholic. I mean, look at what happened in El Salvador, you know, Catholic nuns being murdered. I went down to Colombia back in the late 90s. We were this international relief organization I'm affiliated with. We were offered by the Catholic Church, actually, some property. Down in the Medellin Valley, we went down there, and they had been murdered, all these Catholic activists, by the local right-wing goons.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, find archives, transcripts, our message board, our blog, all kinds of cool stuff. AirAmerica.com as well for the Air America website. Desiree in Whidbey Island, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, I was up there this weekend. Hey, Desiree, what's up?
You were on Whidbey this weekend?
No, I was in your neighborhood, though. I spoke at the Green Festival in Seattle.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, happy birthday to Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah. It was it yesterday?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And I wanted to say how coincidental I thought it was that somebody compared Hillary to Lieberman. I was thinking that myself last night. I couldn't help it. It was a feeling that went over the back of my head, and I thought, you know, who needs enemies when you've got friends like this? I mean,
yeah.
As far as she's just ruining Obama. She needs to stop. She needs to stop making Obama look so bad. She's doing the Republicans' job, and
she needs to tell us why we should vote for her rather than why we shouldn't vote for her opponent.
Exactly, and quit using talking points like the Republicans. I have three of your books, and I think that the cracking the code kind of thing, you know, with the talking points and hammering over lies and lies and lies. you know, until they become the truth, and yeah. and saying elitist and these kinds of comments, you know, to where finally it's, you know, now what's his name's using them, the other side.
John McCain.
Give him any kind of
no, everybody knows who he is. Don't worry about it. Spot on, Desiree, and it really concerns me because I think, frankly, you know, and I've said all along, I think that Hillary Clinton has the potential to be a very good president, and I think she's destroying that potential by going down this road. I think that, you know, she's, you know, just like John Kerry took advice from his advisors not to respond to the Swift Boat veterans and, you know, blah de blah de blah. You go all the way back to Al Gore and Michael Dukakis. I think they were all being advised by Bob Shrum, but whatever. I mean, they all took this advice to, you know, to go do this and do that. And I have this strong suspicion that she's getting really lousy advice. And
someone like Karl Rove, perhaps.
Well, or Mark Penn. I mean, you know, Mark Penn owns the firm, the lobbying firm that owns a division that Charlie Black works for, and Charlie Black is the guy running John McCain's campaign. The whole incestuous nature of Washington politics and Washington lobbyists, you know, spooks me, and I think that she's getting bad advice, and I just hate to see it happening like this. Desiree, thank you so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Dan in Portland on KPOJ. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to make a quick comment. You were talking about the crazy right-wing guys up in the cabins listening to the shortwave or getting worked up about the rights that we're losing because of Bush. I just want to say it's not just the right-wing wackos in the cabins. There's lots of
liberal
gun nuts, I guess you could say.
Sure. No, I've Bernie Sanders has 100% rating with the NRA. You know, in Vermont, you can carry without a license. I talk on the program about how I go back to Michigan. I have three younger brothers. The brother next, you know, closest to me in age, he and his significant other both own a whole bunch of pistols. And, you know, their favorite thing, our favorite thing, Louise and I went with Steve and Tam last time we were in Lansing, go down to the gun range and just do some competition shooting, you know, and, you know, Steve says, you know, want to go bling bling? You know, let's go. Yeah,
exactly.
You know,
every time I hit the range or go out anywhere, I look around the parking lot. I'm not seeing a lot of Bush stickers.
No, the point that I was making is that I was on, you know, these shortwave radio shows. These are the guys who are convinced that the government has been taken over by communists, you know, back in the 50s, and that it, you know, it's. I mean, and the fact that they happen to have guns is almost incidental. It is way beyond that. I mean, there are people who are, you know, this was the Tim McVeigh bunch. Tim McVeigh had read the Turner Diaries, and the Turner Diaries is a book written, you know, by and for that group. And in the Turner Diaries, which is a novel, this guy blows up a federal building in Oklahoma City. And in response to that, the communists who have already taken over the government show their true colors by clamping down on civil liberties, suspending habeas corpus, doing away with posse comitatus, and start rounding people up and putting them in concentration camps. Start rounding up the good white Protestant gun-owning Christians and putting them in concentration camps. And that causes all the other good white gun-owning Protestant Christians to rise up and kill off the Catholics and the Jews and the African Americans and the Hispanics. And in the end of the novel, the only people left are the good white gun-owning Protestants. And that's what Tim McVeigh thought he was going to cause to happen. And I'm telling you, there's a bunch of them out there. There's a startling number of them out there. I've met them. I know them, some of them. I'm not going to say, and maybe they're right. I don't know, but there's, you know, in their concern that the government has been taken over by multinational corporate. I mean, it's rife with anti-Semitism. It's rife with homophobia and racism and all the, you know, I mean, these are just basically very, very, very frightened people. And, you know, I probably shouldn't make fun of them, but anyhow, thanks. And I mean, you know, in as much as we should have compassion for them, I suppose. Dan in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dan, got about a half a minute here before we got to wrap up the show today. What's up?
Big fan of yours.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about, you were talking earlier about the right-wing think tanks and
mm-hmm.
how they had started 70 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, they actually started in response to academia by business pressure.
By business pressure?
By industry. is as response to what they consider to be the left-wing media.
You're a monster.
Whoops, excuse me. Yeah. Okay, got it, Dan. Yeah, and it was the anti-union sentiment, frankly, in my opinion, coming from that. Coming up tomorrow, Citizens United founder President David Bossy. That'll be an interesting one. And the attorney and contributor to Harper's Magazine, Scott Horton, on A Tale of Three Lawyers, which you will find fascinating. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. Make some calls. Show up. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.